And we've got Don Sutherland on the line. G'day, Don. How are you?
G'day, Anne. Hi to all of your listeners.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a very depressing few weeks, I'll have to say, but you've got a very interesting take on the no vote. I mean, I know you're an active supporter of the yes vote, but you've been contemplating what's happened. I was wondering if you'd like to share a few of your thoughts with my listeners.
Yes, well, there's many things that can be said about the result, and I agree with what I've just listened to from Kevin. I agree with the way he's approached it, along with several others who have correctly pointed out that there has been an honest reckoning that shows that there is a racist sentiment along with that, a gullibility to racist ideas that has been lurking beneath the surface of Australian society and is now out in the open. And there is a perverse way in which I think that's a good thing. I think the other thing about, many people have sort of provided more detail about that. And I think there is one dimension of it all that is worth elaborating upon. The other general point about the result is that we do have a very potentially very strong foundation for a much better strategy to start winning battles in solidarity with the leadership of Aboriginal organisations. So when we talk about 40% voting yes, of course that's a defeat, but it's also a foundation that we are clearer about. And secondly, we've seen in the result the emergence of a newer and younger generation of Aboriginal leaders, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders, who are capable of charting the way for us white fellas in the majority of the population. So I think there is some sort of things there we can build with, as well as the insult, in a sense, that the no result commands, or the slapping away, if you like, of the hand that was extended to us by people who have been dominated over by colonial expansion since the white settlement in the late 18th century. Now, the particular thing I think we've got to elaborate on is the class dimensions of the result. And there are two aspects of this. One is the course in terms of the voting pattern, and the second one is in terms of, and I think particularly, the class composition of those who ran the No campaign or funded it. Now, the No campaign, the coordinating centre to that was the Centre for Independent Studies, which is a right-wing think tank. I'm not going to say much more about this. I'm just saying let's explore all this and understand this from the point of view of those who want to build a winning strategy in the future.
What you're really saying is that these elements, these currents that run through the Australian politic, this right-wing current, has that came out in full force during the Voice campaign, is something that needs to be recognised, and clear strategies have to be put in place to deflect their power.
Yeah, well, the power behind the No campaign didn't come out. They kept themselves hidden. But they were able to use key figures who have history in the Centre for Independent Studies and were now active in other organisations whose messaging was able to reach a big majority of the population. Now, so, for example, on the board of the Centre for Independent Studies are extremely wealthy people from corporations like Macquarie Group.
Yeah.
at least three ex-senior executives in Macquarie Group. Three Hills, the international law firm that is the prime legal architect in the writing of the anti-working class laws in our industrial relations laws like the Fair Work Act. You could go on. There are many others. Caltex Australia, JP Morgan Australia, Wesfarmers, ResMed. The American Chamber of Commerce is there.
Oh, my God.
The University of Tasmania is there. CSL, the Commonwealth what used to be called the Commonwealth Searing Laboratories, is there, now a private corporation.
Yeah.
And Australian Oil Shale Holdings. So
oh, my God. All the evil empires there.
I'm not providing any rich detail, but I'm just pointing towards that this the funders and the coordinators and the, if you like, the behind-the-scenes shapers of what the No campaign ended up doing are elitist in their essence, and they are corporate elitist, and they will line up with the major corporations who assisted the Yes campaign, in opposing workers' rights in, for example, the Closing Loopholes Bill.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this is interesting because all they're doing is taking it out of the American right-wing playbook, which using these think tanks, in inverted commas, as the suit for their attack.
Yes, yes, and there's an interaction, and it's a very powerful one, and we need to be talking about it a lot more. Now, the other aspect of the class dimensions of this result is that, and we have to face up to this, that the majority of the working class at just above median wage levels and below voted no. And they did so with a minority of them as active racists, but in general also either accepting and even expressing racist views to the extent that they talked about them. Now, this is a really big issue for progressives and anyone to the left of being progressive. Like
now, that. Are you saying these are the people who say, we won the war, so just suck it up? Or are you talking about the people who feel that they're being undermined and they want to be above, one step above Indigenous people?
I'm talking about the majority of the working class, which itself is a majority of the population, but the majority of the working class who have taken on and to one degree of intensity or another accept a ruling class value, which is to be divided on the basis of race.
Well put. That was very well put of you.
I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, the irony in all this is that in our working class history, there have been several moments where the low-income working class have done really wonderful things in solidarity with Aboriginal people who have been in struggle. Now, over that history, and that includes, for example, the solidarity of the Sheet Metal Workers Union with the first national manifesto of Aboriginal organisations in 1938 in printing the document so that it could be distributed more widely, especially among the working class. That's just one example.
One of the examples was the business about asbestos. So I don't know if this has been lost to people's memory, but Indigenous people were used to mine asbestos. Because for some reason or other, apparently they were immune to being killed by it. And that was one of the areas that the campaign against asbestos unearthed.
Yes, and the important thing there is that any idea that it must be naturally sown, that middle and low income working class Australians would tend to be racist is wrong.
Yeah, no, it is.
Contested terrain, if you like.
Yeah.
I think this has enormous implications for strategy. I think the other thing, you see, what we've got to understand is that those who voted no, working class people, infected in one way or another, so that their own consciousness was influenced by racist ideas, is capable of being turned around so that they are not. And they get something, and there is something they get right. In my observation, and I've discussed this with a lot of people now, those who voted no and who were visibly on lower incomes were not really willing to talk. They were sullen and resentful. But to the extent you get them to talk, they were heartily suspicious of the elites, as they define them, running the Yes campaign. And there is an element of truth in that when you know that the Yes campaign was heavily funded by major corporations who, as they say, will oppose workers' rights, who don't like the right to strike.
But interestingly enough, the No campaign was financed by the same groups.
Not exclusively, but yes. Now, that means that what middle and low income working class people are dealing with is, of course, the priority struggle for their material day-to-day living. And that is a harsh struggle and getting harsher. And in that context, being asked to be generous by people who have not shown much generosity to them is a big problem. In other words, there were messaging problems in the Yes campaign to the working class. The second big feature of our working class at that in those lower incomes is, of course, they're not in unions. 12% of workers in unions. And so they sense and feel an alienation of the from the decision-making process that goes on in Australian society. They're alienated from the power, from power. And they're right about it. That's actually true.
Well, they are right.
And so in any evolution of the next stage of strategy to win battles in solidarity with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and in winning the broader fights that the working class needs to win, that spin off as and provide positive momentum for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander struggles, that interaction is incredibly important in the future. So I think this sort of class dimension of the result has not been satisfactorily discussed so far, and yet it's essential. And I'll say this somewhat provocatively. I'm not convinced that a lot of the people that I know who were dead serious, solid activists in the Yes campaign are really good at talking with relatively impoverished white fellow workers and their.
I think you're right. I think this is,
And
I'm glad
I
you're
think
having this conversation.
and that has to change. It is essential it changes for general struggles of the working class as well as the particular anti-racist dimension of struggles being generated by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and their organisations.
So what you're really saying is that it exposes the incredibly unequal society that we've created, and that when it comes to working class struggles, that these rifts need to be examined to get a more positive outcome in workers' struggles at the coalface, right? To use a coalface. Yeah. We have to change that word, don't we?
Yes, we do. That's where I'm heading, and I'm in a sense I'm putting forward what I'm saying in an exploratory way. I'm convinced that the basic concept must be worked out, and that is that what are the class dimensions of this honest reckoning? But the detail of it, I'm happy to learn about and discuss further. We've got to dig into that. Because it has implications at three levels for future strategy. I leave aside because we haven't got the time, but I think there was a couple of serious fault lines in the S strategy, which were you could not find in the No campaign actually, but. That's to do with how you understand the preparation for a major campaign and things like that, which I won't go into in great detail. But there are three ways in which the strategy issue for the future is important, keeping in mind that we have a foundation to build an effective strategy. The first one is purely parliamentary, and I'll deal with it briefly. Dutton is clearly not going to fuss too much about the coalition's loss of the Peel seats. He believes that the LNP recovery to parliamentary power can be found in the Labor and Greens' vulnerability in the lower income outer western suburbs and regional seats. And we should not assume that the sort of system of government and so on can shield us from that Trumpian style strategy. All right, we've got
That's right. It's well spotted and well framed. What you just said. Yep.
Yeah. Now the second aspect of it is, what will be the focal points for struggles that are of major significance to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. And they are going to chart that out for us, but they will hinge around things like closing the gap, the treaty, but also deaths in custody.
Yeah, deaths in custody. I mean, and as Lydia Thorpe pointed out in a wry sort of a way, that getting rid of the hang points in prisons won't just help black fellas, it will help white fellas as well, she said.
Well, I think that's a useful starting point, but I think the bigger point about the deaths in custody is its recommendations remain a relevant program for those who wish to work in solidarity with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and their organisations. It's a platform, if you like, a political platform almost.
Yeah, because the thing about it is you can't understand the resistance over the practical remelioration of these sites. Why can't they just do it? Because it's so odd.
But I think we're going to learn a lot from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the weeks and months ahead about what the focal points will be, and we have to pay attention and listen and learn from that. Keep in mind that, just by the way, with the death and custody report, I think one of the co-authors of that, with the judge responsible for the final production of that document, was Pat Dobson.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other thing is truth-telling. Now, my hunch is that from the point of view of the thousands of new activists for Yes, the big question to them is what they can do to maintain the heavier lifting they committed to maintain that with a focus on reaching and discussing and learning about the truth of our history, especially the attempt to destroy Aboriginality in Australia.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
The test, if you like, of how Fair Dinkum, that new band of activists, thousands of them, can maintain that heavy lifting, go to another notch or two higher, and take truth learning into a sensitive relationship with the low-income working class.
We have to finish there. That's a good point to finish. I know you've got a thousand other things to say. Very good and reflective comments this week. Thank you very much for spending time with us, Don.
Good on you, Annie, and best wishes to everybody. The struggle, la lotta continua.
Have a good day.
All the best. Bye for now.